Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's the Global Climate Report. NASA says 2005 will be the world's hottest year on record. Oceans are rising, Pacific islands are vanishing, the Arctic permafrost is melting, polar bears are now reported to be facing starvation, and the world is still struggling for a consensus on how to respond to global warming that will include the USA. The world's biggest holdout is also its biggest polluter. In Montreal last week, at a huge follow-up meeting on the Kyoto Protocols, Bush administration officials protested, pushed back, even walked out at one point, before finally agreeing to talk with no promises, and the time to respond is shrinking. Joining me now in the studio is Pete Spotts, science correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He covered the two-week conference in Montreal. Pete, wonderful to have you.
Good to be here, Tom.
Thanks for being here. And from Washington, Eileen Clausen, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change and Strategies for the Global Environment. She worked in the EPA under President Reagan and President Bush Sr. She was Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans and International Environmental and Scientific Affairs. There's a mouthful in the Clinton administration. Eileen Clausen, thank you for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Pete Spotts, first to you. You covered this thing front to back, first to last. We're a little confused. People are coming away with their head in their hands. People are coming away saying that they've turned a corner. What's the bottom line on the Montreal conference? Progress? Not? How do you paint it?
I think there is progress. There was a lot of concern, as you pointed out, about the effects of global warming beginning to really take hold and whether or not we may be approaching that tipping point. So there's a real sense of urgency. And I think one of the things that people noticed at this meeting, it wasn't just the industrial countries who were worried about it, but many of the developing countries, particularly now that the Kyoto Protocol has been activated as of this past February, a lot of developing countries are beginning to see these effects and are a lot more willing to begin to think about additional steps they can take to help deal with the problem. So I think in many respects, this has been a step forward, albeit a modest one.
Not just waiting on the industrialized nations, perhaps not even waiting on the United States. Eileen Clausen, how did you come away? Heartened or something else?
Maybe a little bit of something else. I mean, it was a case where governments agreed, the United States most reluctantly, but everybody else, that we actually need to move forward. But the timetable for moving forward is not very well defined. The steps that people will actually take will probably take a decade before they actually come to fruition. So I'm not sure that the response is equal to the problem.
Pete, remind us what the goal of Montreal was. Why were all these people meeting, 10,000 environmentalists and government officials from all around the world? Why?
Well, at the risk of sounding a little cynical, and I don't quite mean it that way, the ultimate goal of this meeting in many respects was to continue talking. Now, within the Kyoto Protocol, the meeting actually did put the wraps on some on the rules of the road for implementing the Kyoto Protocols. There were some other sort of important housekeeping elements they dealt with and got out of the way so that the protocols could actually take effect, become active. People could start working with the various mechanisms that the protocol lays out.
But in a way, they're looking beyond the horizon
exactly.
of the Kyoto Protocols.
Exactly.
This goes back to first to a 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change, a UN document. The U.S. is part of that.
That's
and then
correct.
Comes Kyoto, 97, 150, 60 nations sign on, 35 industrialized nations agree that by 2012 they will reduce their greenhouse gas emissions to, what, 5% below their 1990 levels? Have I got that right, Pete?
excuse me, yes. It's slightly more than the global average is slightly more. It's about 5.2, 5.5%. Mm-hmm. But This was also the meeting under the Kyoto Protocol at which the countries that ratified it were required to sit down and begin to talk about next steps. What happens? What will we do after 2012 when the first commitment period expires? So in a sense, to come out of it, agreeing with Ellen's caveats, mm-hmm. and they're coming out of this meeting to agree to continue talking was, in broad brush, the objective going in. One of the things that is sort of implied in one of the agreements elements they agreed on was even though they did not set a firm date for finishing up the process for negotiating, they did sort of imply that they wanted things to happen in a time frame that would there would be no gap between 2012 and 20, and what comes after.
So as soon as the Kyoto timetable runs out, they would go right ahead with more cuts. Yeah. We'll look at the U.S. role. We'll look at what's coming after 2012. But Eileen Clausen, first on Kyoto itself, has it been successful? President Bush said this won't work for the U.S. economy, but has it worked at all? Are we going to see those targets of 5% below 1990 levels in the signatory countries met?
I think it's touch and go. I think in Europe, it is highly likely that the countries as a whole will meet that target, although some individually will not, and others will do a little bit better. I think Canada and Japan will have a very hard time meeting their target. So maybe not, but maybe they won't miss it by a huge amount.
So is that then sort of retroactive justification to the Bush administration view that mandated targets don't work, that we should depend on technology and voluntary efforts, or not, Eileen?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is that voluntary efforts won't get us even close to where we need to go. Do we need technology? Absolutely. Can you have technology and mandatory targets at the same time? Of course. In fact, I think that's what you need. You need some carrots and you need some sticks. So I'm not sure that the Bush administration should feel vindicated about Kyoto. It did go into effect. Countries are working to meet those targets. And yes, technology is important, but it's not the only thing.
Pete Spotts, at one point in Montreal, the U.S. delegation walked out of a session. What was that session? Why the walkout? What was the resistance from Washington throughout this big meeting?
Well, as the administration has its own program of reducing greenhouse gas intensity, basically the amount of greenhouse gas emissions per unit of economic growth. I think it's 18% by 2012. And that's its program. And within the context of these international talks, specifically within the Framework Convention on Climate Change, mm-hmm. which we have ratified, it was adamant about not talking about future commitments under the Framework Convention. And as people were discussing ways to bring developing countries more actively into the process, there was a lot of tension within the delegations, particularly with the U.S., that they just did not want the discussion to go in a direction that would appear to commit the U.S. to anything
in the future. Anything that suggested formal commitment.
The U.S. position essentially was, we're happy to come in here and talk about what we're doing now. We're happy to come in here and talk about the science of climate change, but we're not willing to talk about future commitments under this mechanism.
And at the end, the U.S. agreed to do something. What was that?
Well, the U.S. essentially agreed not to do, and this is sort of informal, was essentially not to block the process. What happened was that provision they were upset about, the wording was changed in such a way that it was very clear that as people discuss the future, we're not talking about specific hard targets for countries. What we want to do is explore more flexible approaches to reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Who's the we there?
We is the international community, the mm-hmm. parties to the Framework Convention, and ultimately, eventually, the parties to the protocol.
The big kind of surprise noise at the end of the week last week in Montreal was from former President Bill Clinton. He said the Bush administration was flat wrong on Kyoto, unusually strong language for a former president toward a sitting president, and he spoke about the costs and benefits of addressing the problem.
We know from every passing year we get more and more objective data that if we had a serious, disciplined effort to apply on a large scale existing clean energy and energy conservation technologies, we could meet and surpass the Kyoto targets easily in a way that would strengthen, not weaken, our economy. That's the main point I came here to make.
But the former president said the international community also needs to reach out to work with the United States.
I believe that if we just keep working with the administration, we will find some specific things we can do that are consistent with the targets I believe in, that don't require them to embrace targets they're not about to embrace, but do give them a way forward to do things that are important.
We're looking at global warming and the American role. My guests in this hour, Eileen Clausen, president of the Pew Center on Global Climate Change and Strategies for the Global Environment. She worked under Presidents Reagan and Bush Sr. And as Assistant Secretary of State under Bill Clinton. Pete Spotts is with us. He's science correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, covered the Montreal event, the big event there. And now from Washington, we are also joined by Sam Thernstrom. He is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He was spokesperson for the Council on Environmental Quality under the George W. Bush administration from August of 2001 through early 2003, the period when President Bush announced he was not going to implement Kyoto. Sam Thernstrom, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you.
So what do you make of the U.S. role at this point? Is it a constructive one? Is the U.S. leaning in the right direction? What have we learned from your perspective about Kyoto, Sam?
I do think it's a constructive role. It's a contrary voice, certainly, as you say, to many of the nations of the world, but I think it's an important one. The Kyoto approach is proving to be a failure, as it has been for the 8 years since it was first negotiated, and we need to have other approaches as well that the Bush administration is developing. I think the Bush administration approach is to treat the climate change challenge as a marathon, not a sprint, and that slow and steady progress, rather than short-term and unrealistic targets, is much more constructive.
But do we get to decide the timetable? Lots of scientists saying we better start sprinting soon or we're not going to win this race.
Well, and I would argue, in fact, that we are making significant progress under the Bush administration approach. We're certainly doing a lot more than we did under the Clinton administration. The United States government is investing massively in both the science and the technology development. The Bush policy has been, in fact, to do everything that the Clinton administration did and much, much more. The clip that you just played from President Clinton in Montreal is quite striking. The president claims, ex-president claims, that we can easily meet and surpass the Kyoto targets using existing technologies and still grow our economy. Now, if that was true, you would think that when he was president, Bill Clinton might have actually submitted the Kyoto Protocol to the Senate for ratification. Of course, he never did because he knew that 95 U.S. senators had come out against the Kyoto Protocol.
Sam Thernstrom, you've said that you're not entirely satisfied that the implementation of the Bush plan, even on its own terms, is not great. In what respects?
Well, I do think that President Bush has had the right conceptual approach to say, rather than establishing arbitrary and unrealistic targets that we can't meet, as the Kyoto nations are proving that they can't meet, that we should have targets for steady improvement in our greenhouse gas emissions that vary depending upon our rate of growth. That intensity metric, as it's called, is a much more realistic approach, and it's much more attractive to the developing world. But I would fault the administration in not actually implementing all of its policies as effectively as it could. We're spending billions of dollars on high-tech research and development, but that money is not being very wisely spent, is not being coordinated with a long-term plan. And there are some specific promises that the president made in February of 2002 when he announced his alternative policies to Kyoto that he hasn't followed through on. One of the most important ones is he promised to provide transferable credits to American companies that choose to take action today to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. The president said for those companies that act now, we shouldn't punish them under some future cap and trade program by not giving them credit for what they've done now. We should give them verifiable, transferable credits that will be valuable in the future. I think that's a very important policy mechanism. It was a key element of the policy at the time it was announced. And unfortunately, almost 3 years later, it actually has not been introduced.
Still waiting on that front. Eileen Clausen, take us straight into this debate over the conceptual approach. We clearly have to get it right. We're hearing louder and louder warnings. I'm looking here, Columbia University economist Jeffrey Heal saying, you know, just look at the melting in the Arctic, the rising sea level in the Pacific. He says this process, that is global warming, is starting, and frankly, it is starting faster than anyone expected. So what are the horns of the conceptual debate at this point, Eileen, and where has it evolved since Kyoto?
Well, I think, let me come back to some of the things that Sam just said. I don't think anyone is in favor of unrealistic targets, but to suggest that we can't take steps now that would be better than President Bush's target of an 18% emission intensity reduction by 2012, I think is simply wrong. If you look at all the companies that have taken steps and set their own targets, because many companies have set their own targets, virtually all have done so at, and some of them have met those targets at no net cost. So there are efficiency improvements that are possible, I think, across the board.
But we should just say there, the challenge is so big. I mean, we're talking 5% targets with Kyoto, but I'm reading scientists here out of Montreal saying on the other side of 2012, we may need 30, 50, 60, 70% reductions to duck the bullet here.
Right. But I mean, I think what we have to do is do what we can now and be quite aggressive about that, and then put in place some longer term targets that require technology development and technology diffusion so we can meet some targets as we move down into the next couple of decades.
So what are the
We're not going to be able to solve this in 1 minute. It's do what you can now and make sure you have a very clear direction with some really viable targets for the future.
So take us into the core debate or debates here then. The United States is still standing as the odd man out. What's the conceptual argument?
Well, the United States' position is essentially business as usual and a certain amount of money for long-term technology development. I think that's wrong on both counts. We can certainly do more in the short term, and long-term technology is fine, but you have to find a way to get it into the marketplace. And without a clear signal or some kind of a target, it isn't going to end up in the marketplace. So I think it's inadequate on both grounds.
You mean the market alone won't bring in the new technology that President Bush says he's counting on?
No, I mean, unless you have something that draws it into the market. It's a push and a pull, and not just a push.
Joining us right now from Oxford, England, is Mark Linus. He's author of High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis, the culmination of a 3-year journey around the world looking at areas affected by climate change. Mark Linus, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Make it real for us. What's the continuing evidence that global warming is advancing?
Well, it's very strong, and as somebody mentioned earlier on, it's getting stronger all the time, and in fact, we continually are being surprised by how conservative the scientific projections have actually been. Just to take one case study as an example, the Greenland ice sheet is melting much more rapidly than any of the models have projected, and there were speakers recently at the American Geophysical Union meeting in California who told us about how some of the glaciers are now the fastest moving ice streams on the Earth, and hundreds of cubic kilometers of water are going to be pouring into the North Atlantic, and this already seems to be affecting the Gulf Stream, which, of course, is the major heat engine in that part of the world and keeps northwestern Europe a lot warmer than it would otherwise be for its latitude. And that Gulf Stream is also slowing down, another thing which the scientists haven't projected to happen for 50 to 100 years. So The scientific information that we're getting is very clear on this, and actually is a lot more alarming than perhaps many people would understand.
Mark Linus, what about the consensus in Europe, if there is one, on Kyoto and its effectiveness? Sam Thernstrom with us, he's been with the Bush administration, says it's failed. How does Europe see it?
Well, I personally have lost count of the number of times I've seen headlines in newspapers saying Kyoto is dead. And many of those have been wishful thinking, because Kyoto is very clearly alive, and the Montreal meeting has demonstrated this. And in the absence of any leadership from the American side of the Atlantic, the leadership on climate change has very strongly come from Europe, along with Canada as the host of the conference this time round. But it's really the European Union which has pushed forward on the Kyoto targets and has set up its own carbon trading mechanisms within Europe.
And how is Europe looking at the United States? Looking at the United States at this point, Mark, how's America seen on this front?
Well, America's seen as I hesitate to use the term, but it's almost like a rogue state. The rest of the world is united around climate change. Even Australia seems to be coming back on board to Kyoto, and America's standing outside that. It's very difficult to understand quite how things are seen from an American perspective when you sit here in Europe and, you know, you read about this in the papers every single day, and even the politicians of all parties, certainly in the UK, are taking the climate change issue very seriously indeed, to see to see what's happening in Washington, which is more or less a continuing denial of the problem. Although they have some very good PR people, I have to say, they speak all the right language, and all this business about emissions intensity is basically just to cover for the fact that the Bush administration's plan are that U.S. emissions will carry on rising. It will continue to be the dirtiest nation in the world, and the rest of the planet can go hang, more or less.
There is a global perspective. Mark Lynas in Oxford, England, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Pete Spotts, you've listened to everything in Montreal and what we're hearing here today. I mean, is there a gap between what people are ready to try to rein in global warming and what the U.S. government's prepared to do? Or do you think Americans are on board with Bush policy? I'm seeing polls here that say an awful lot now don't like it. Are people prepared to deal with the kind of major changes that it may ultimately take to get global warming in hand?
I think they're getting there. One of the most striking contrasts, I was also at these talks in 2000 and 2001, and at that time, the environmental groups were holding press conferences, bringing representatives of developing countries to talk about how global warming was affecting their home countries. And for the first time this year, environmental groups held a press conference with a delegation of local officials, business people from the southeastern United States after this record-breaking hurricane season. And as you know, there's been this discussion over the extent to which this might or might not, global warming might or might not have played a role in the hurricane season. But now all of a sudden you have essentially a delegation of people who feel they've been affected from the leading industrial country in the world coming forward and saying, you know, I understand we're red states, but don't take us for granted on this issue, because we're now we think there's a serious problem and it needs to be dealt with.
You've got Billy Graham talking about people, Christians, taking stewardship of the creation and right on down the line. It's a fascinating conversation, and there we heard from the UK the charge of U.S. as rogue nation, big polluter. We'd like to be a leading nation by whatever means will work here. I'm grateful to all of you for being with us this hour. Pete Spotts with the Christian Science Monitor, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Eileen Clausen at the Pew Center on Global Climate Change in Washington, thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Clausen.
Thank you.
And Sam Thernstrom at the American Enterprise Institute. Mr. Thernstrom, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.